And what I'm going to do in this last part of today's session is really talk about, go back to that discourse analytical set of approaches. Because it's close to the type of sociology that I tend to focus on in my work. B, because it's an important skill that you, practical skill that you, you get the opportunity to practice in this course, that is looking at discourse, looking at the way people speak, analysing and coding various kinds of textual data. That's one of the central tasks. Most sociological research involves interpreting some sort of text. That's what we do most of the time, whether it be spoken text or written text. And also because there have been a number of interesting studies about claims making, sense making, position taking on Europe, which I'd like to introduce to you. So let's remind ourselves first what I said on Monday about some of the limits of survey data. In terms of testing people's notions of justice and people's sense of what's fair, how things should be. And I'm going to do so by looking back at the EU cross study, which I talked about a little bit on Monday, which, if you remember, was based largely on a six-country survey of public attitudes to what they called social transnationalism, experiences as well of living and moving across countries. But also used a few qualitative interviews with respondents selected from among the people who had filled out their questionnaire to explore some of the issues that they raised in more detail. And that's a common technique in sociological research, where you do a quantitative survey, you do a multiple choice survey, which you would either face to face or online very often these days, or by telephone, and then you sub-select a sample to do what researchers often call an exploratory in-depth survey of some of the issues with a sub-sample of your main sample, and it's a way of overcoming some of the limitations of the quantitative nature of survey research by at least going into some more detail and allowing people to respond in a more open-ended manner to some of the issues raised. But I'm going to suggest that it's a limited way of addressing some of the flaws of survey research. I hope I'm going to be able to show you how it goes so far, but only so far, in overcoming the weaknesses of survey research. So, to recap to focus on one aspect of the EU cross study, they looked at attitudes to solidarity within Europe, and they did so both on the abstract level and by taking a concrete example. They ask people, are they generally in favour of, in other words, of solidarity between the peoples of the EU? They also ask them a hypothetical question: would they be in favour of sharing a burden in the event of some natural disaster? And then they asked a topical question in 2012-13. It was already topical, about solidarity in the case of a debt crisis of southern European countries. This was actually before the if you like, the peak of the Greek debt crisis, when Greece was literally bailed out in 2015, But already in 12-13, when they did the survey, there were plans afoot for bailing out not just Greece, but Spain, Portugal, Italy were also in danger of needing support to address excessive levels of debt, which meant they couldn't afford the levels of public spending because of the European rules, the strict European rules that apply to Eurozone countries about minimising your levels of debt, and so on. So they found that there was quite a high level of support among their respondents for solidarity. But not surprisingly, they found a higher level for the abstract question than for the specific question when it comes down to are you in favour of giving Spain, Portugal, Greece money to compensate for their debt problems right now. People were less likely to say yes than when they were asked in general, do you support solidarity between peoples of the EU? And the rank order of countries also changed. So for example, Germans were expressed more abstract and hypothetical solidarity than the Brits did, but less on the debt question. Which is again not surprising, given that the Brits were not members of the Eurozone, so wouldn't necessarily be affected by the bailouts for the Eurozone countries, and the Brits being less likely than the Germans to express support for solidarity in the abstract might just reflect their generally hostile attitudes towards deepening European integration. So there's a logical explanation. It makes sense, does that change in the rank order. They're also they also found that transnational backgrounds, practices, and human capital don't explain the patterns of variation. So if you remember, they were mapping whether people had travelled abroad for various reasons, spent lots of time abroad, whether they did other kinds of transnational practices like talking to people on the telephone abroad, interacting with people online abroad, sending money abroad, watching foreign television programmes, that kind of thing. All these kinds of transnational practices they mapped, they constructed an index which allowed them to say someone is, you know, a high level of transnational behaviour, someone else has a low level of transnational behaviour. And you might expect the people who had a higher level of transnational behaviour to be more in favour of solidarity among European peoples, but they found that wasn't the case. There wasn't any logical correlation there between levels of transnational behaviour and support for European solidarity. So that seemed like a paradox of the survey results. What they did find was that there was one measure which was a strong predictor of solidarity, and that was measures of European identification. That's responses to the question, do you feel European, as opposed to national. So if people said, yes, I feel like I'm a European citizen, then they were more likely to also support solidarity, practical solidarity between countries. But on the whole, they found that the correlation between the measures, all the measures generally, was not strong enough to warrant treating them as a measure of one single concept. So the idea of a single solidarity concept, a single defining, they couldn't pinpoint, if you like, the typical person who supports more solidarity. They couldn't say what that person looks like from their survey results. They did find though some anecdotal evidence from their exploratory qualitative interviews they did with a subsample. And they found, first of all, that maybe the paradox is partially explained by a linguistic phenomenon they hadn't really thought about, which is that the very term solidarity might not necessarily mean the same thing in different European languages. Which they were asking, they obviously did these interviews in the native language of the people they were interviewing, and I think they had respondents from Spain, from Italy, from Denmark, from Britain, from Germany, and Romania. That was it. So, from the deeper discussions they had in the qualitative interviews, they found that perhaps in the southern European states, there was a sort of the in-group. Okay, you had in most languages you have a sense that solidarity implies this kind of gradation of worth. So you have in-group members are more. If someone who's considered an in-group member is more likely to be seen as deserving of solidarity, deserving of support, than someone who's an out-group member. So we differentiate when we talk about solidarity between those who belong to us and those who don't. But they also found that that it wasn't just a matter of seeing someone as European or not European, someone that's taking an anti-European attitude, and therefore bearing group out-group distinction would then be between people who were part of their nation and people who were not part of their nation. It wasn't quite as simple as that. It was more that there was an additional factor in relation to attitudes that portrayed people as undeserving due to the financial irresponsibility of certain countries. And they found that by looking at the media coverage of the debt crises, and found that creditor countries, so the German press, if you like, take an example, would frame southern European states as undeserving due to the fact that they had in the past behaved irresponsibly financially, or that they were perceived as generally and therefore likely in the future to use corrupt practices. So they would find their respondents saying, well, it's not that I'm not against solidarity with them, it's that I don't want to give money to the southern European countries because I don't think they'll spend it wisely. So it wasn't the solidarity itself wasn't the question. It was more the southern European states in that particular case were seen as undeserving because of an implied financial irresponsibility of their governments. But the media in the debtor countries framed the crisis in a very different way, reversing the positions and portraying the North European lenders as irresponsible or arrogant. So they were, if you like, blaming the banks for causing the crisis by lending irresponsibly, but also criticising the arrogance of Europe, of North European states, for, if you like, having different measures when it comes to their own populations and other parts of the Eurozone. And these frames were then adopted by ordinary people to justify their attitudes. So the Spanish respondents, for example, shared the moral frame that blamed their own profligacy for the crisis, but nevertheless justified a claim to support using an idea of contract. So wealthier members help poor members in exchange for benefits that flow from the single market. They would argue that it's kind of solidarity out of obligation. You know, you give us money now, the whole Eurozone will prosper. You'll earn money from it in the future because we'll spend more on German cars. You know, that was the attitude which a lot of the Spanish respondents used to justify, despite the fact that they actually shared the German image of Spanish government as being not very responsible financially. German respondents, by contrast, would justify their lack of solidarity, not wanting to help out, by saying charity begins at home, if you like. A saying in English. I don't know if you understand it. Košile je bližší než Kabát in Czech. But it's your shirt is closer than your coat. So you should mind your own business first, is the kind of essence of what they're saying. So yes, I'm in favour of solidarity, but it's not that I'm differentiating between... it's not that I'm anti-foreigner, it's just that you've got to... We've got pressing cases of that are in need of solidarity here in Germany. So they're making the point that there's poverty here in Germany, and we need to address those problems that are closer to us first before we address the problems that are further from us. So I'm merely saying that when they got to the, they went some way in their quality interviews to kind of resolving some of the conundrums, some of the paradoxes they found when they mapped the patterns of solidarity, and they found some logic to people's positions based when they started analysing the arguments people use, the claims that they make, the way they either the way they contested the implicit claim that you should express solidarity, that it's a good thing to show solidarity with others. So the excuses that the Germans made for not doing so had some logic. The demand that the Spaniards made, despite agreeing with the criticism of their own government, had some logic when you look at the details of their argument. And that just really shows the value of doing some form of discourse analysis to actually get to the bottom of how people are making sense of the world they live in, and if you like, making their own attitudes in line with some sense of justice, justifying their own attitudes by reference to a higher principle of justice. People are not necessarily just irrational when they take an attitude which isn't it, apparently in their objective interests or in line with the profile of the type of person socio-demographically you might expect to hold a particular type of opinion. So that obliges us to look at something which is often called claims making in the public sphere. I'm just going to take you briefly through a couple of examples of how people have applied the concept of claims making to European integration. Díaz Medrano is one person who did so, using newspaper articles published in six countries to analyse how the media talk about European integration, and not just the media, but the people the media are quoting. So he essentially is looking at the media as a model of, or a microcosm of, the public sphere. And he sees the media and the public sphere as an interface between elite views and citizen reactions to those views. What he actually found, though, was that non-political actors were rarely represented in the debate. So the debate on European integration was dominated by the elite. It was essentially mapping what the elite think about the whole process of European integration. And he, just to point on his methodology there, he's looking at the sources of authority that the actors represented in the media used to justify various claims as relation to European integration. The findings, therefore, were that if we ask ourselves what from the media content, what it seems that political elites are concerned about when they're quoted in the media, it's things like the surrender of sovereignty. It's not things like the surrender of sovereignty. These are things they are concerned about: surrender of sovereignty, transfer of competences, and the subsidiarity principle. So, things that relate to the political construction of Europe. And things that relate to the intergovernmental aspects of European integration. How much power should national governments have in relation to European institutions? How much power should be devolved to regions and local authorities, for example? Questions of institutional design are not a matter of much concern for them. Which is interesting because he was doing his research in the lead up to the constitutional referendum in the Netherlands and France, because the formation of the constitutional treaty, when the object of concern for the European institutions themselves was very much the institutional design, and that was what they were about to consult the public on. So he found. He also wanted to know whether what kind of values people referred to in relation to the European Union. So when they were making claims in relation to European issues, to what higher principles did they appeal? Did they say Europe represents democracy? Did they say Europe represents diversity? And did they make a virtue of Europe's cultural heritage? And so on. What was it about Europe that they invoked in order to try and make a case for European integration one way or the other? And they found that, again, this wasn't talked about very much in the media discourse, except when there was some potential threat, some existential threat was perceived to some values. So in the period he was surveying, it was the most obvious example was the Haider affair in Austria, where a far right party, the Freedom Party in Austria, for the first time was invited to form part of the governing coalition by the Austrian Christian Democrats in the 1990s, and that was seen as at the time by was condemned by most other European states at the time as on the grounds that you shouldn't, that they're essentially a fascist party, you shouldn't, they should be beyond the pale for a democratic party like the Christian Democrats. And so there was talk of sanctions against Austria, there was talk of expelling Austria from various decision making for or withdrawing their voting rights from European Council, from the European Council. And that was the point where discussion in the media did start to revolve around, well, what actually does the EU represent in terms of values? Can we say there are some European values attached to democracy by which we can then condemn Austria for having infringed those values? So that was the only kind of situation, this kind of crisis situation, where we got to learn what EU values were. Because the constitutional crisis then was framed more in terms of European versus a national identity. And yet, according to Diaz Medrano, he comes to the view that essentially what it was about was more different concerns of elites and other sections of the population. So the elites were interested in the European project insofar as it related to the market, to democracy, to the polity. But they didn't talk about citizens' concerns, which might be to do with cultural diversity or the impact of globalisation and social security. He was essentially looking at, to put it very succinctly, what kind of issues you might expect to be represented in a debate about Europe integration are strongly represented in the public sphere of the mass media, and what kind of issues are absent from that public sphere. And he found that there are important silences that might relate to citizens' concerns, and that the dominant tone of the debate, whether it be to do with these rare invocations of Europe's values, or whether it be to do with competences and sovereignty and so on, or whether it be to do with the institution design, which was, if you like, a concern for the Brussels elite, but not for the national media, then there was this kind of discrepancy between a high-level debate going on amongst different factions of an elite, and a whole set of different concerns, which as we've seen with the social movement research, European regulation touches upon, but didn't get echoed in the discourse that he analysed via a pure content analysis, really, of European media. This is another example of discourse analysis relating to referenda. This was again France. Schumann looked at pre-referendum debate in France, the Netherlands, and Ireland. I think I'm probably going to skip through that for lack of time. But again, just the point. He uses his analysis of the debate really to counteract an argument that people voted no in those referenda simply because they were ill-informed. And he says that actually when you look at how people talked about it rather than in the debates, rather than simply measuring their degree of knowledge through a survey about, you know, are you aware how Europe takes decisions, you know, testing their general knowledge about how European institutions function, for example, that's, and then maybe trying to correlate that with attitudes towards their pro or European sentiment, or their voting for or against the constitutional treaty. He says that you can't treat knowledge as constructed in such a simplistic manner as that. Yes, knowledge is key to understanding the campaigns and the results, but you have to analyse them in their complexity. So it wasn't the Irish, for example, were as aware of, or not aware as the French of what Europe was proposing in terms of collaboration in military matters, to take one example. Whereas in France, you know, you could be opposed to the submission of France to NATO, and therefore more likely to be in favour of European integration and in common defence policy, because a French voter would see Europe as a kind of a preferable alternative. A common European defence force would be a preferable alternative to NATO if you're anti-NATO. In Ireland, a common European defence force for someone who's opposed to NATO would not be a preferable alternative, because Ireland is not a member of NATO and Ireland has a neutral stance on defence matters. So a common European army would be just as bad as the common NATO army from an Irish voter's perspective. So in other words, both could be equally well informed about the proposals, both could have the same sorts of attitude towards militarisation, and yet one could be voting for the constitution because it weakens NATO, whereas the other would be against the constitution because they're against any form of military collaboration. See what I mean? And again, we can look at environmental arguments for a similar contrast. Here we found Netherlands were the odd one out. Schumann did. So most people who used arguments in relation to the environment, who were concerned about the environment, would be like in Ireland and France, were in favour of the constitutional treaty because they saw the constitutional treaty. They saw Europe in general. They know Europe in general has this kind of raft of environmental regulation that protects the environment in their eyes. In the Netherlands, on the other hand, the national environmental regulation in a lot of aspects is stricter than the European environmental regulation. The Netherlands has higher environmental standards in many areas than Europe does. So environmental arguments are suddenly not a vote winner for the treaty, because the Dutch voter can turn around and say, well, we have higher standards here anyway than Europe, so we don't need Europe to tell us what to do in the environment. We already do it better than Europe. So again, the same information, the same claims people are making could lead to different decisions on a concrete issue, depending on, you know, the national frame of the debate. There's another version of claims making goes together with the what's called the sociology of critique. She's identified in particular with Luc Boltanski and Laurent Thévenot in France, but it's become more widely used in sociology, and particularly what's called pragmatic sociology. And Paul Block has got an interesting article on the reading list. He used to teach this course before me here at Charles University, actually. And he shows using it. He shows that claims refer to a typology which Boltanski and Thévenot call the orders of worth. And they derived from political theory a series of higher principles, principles of justice, if you like, that are used when people make arguments to justify a claim. So if you say, I believe in such and such because it's in the public interest, for example, then you would be appealing to a civic order of worth in Boltanski and Thévenot's classification. If you say, I believe in such and such because that's what the majority of people think, you'd be appealing to what they call an opinion-based order of worth, where you go with the majority. If you say, I believe in such and such because it's good for the economy, you'd be appealing to what they call an industrial order of worth. So you see what I mean? There are various different, what they call civic grammars or orders of worth, which you can use to justify a claim based on what you think, what kind of notion of the higher good you hold, what kind of thing you think really matters or holds authority in argument making. And based on that, he looked at ways people either legitimised or criticised the EU, again looking at media discourse. And he found that forms of critique of the EU, he was particularly interested in critiques of the EU from a far left perspective, could either be reformist or radical. And if they were reformist, there were two types. So they could either be saying that, you know, okay, they've got the principles right, but their practices don't live up to what they claim they believe in. So we, for example, we both believe in democracy. I believe in democracy. The EU believes in democracy, but what, they're not acting democratically. So we need to reform the way they act to be the way they argue that the way we both believe they should act. There's also a second version of the reformist one, which criticises one civic grammar with another one. So there, it's criticising the EU as a market in the name of the EU as a civic order. That's a very common critique on the left. That was the slogan we had, remember, from the French referendum, that it's not a social Europe, it's a liberal Europe. Would conform to that kind of critique in a way. Because it's often presented as rescuing the EU by restoring the foundational ideals. So that kind of argument would be the form of, Europe was set up as a model of peace and democracy after World War II, and it's become this free market trading, free trade zone. It's become something which it wasn't set up to do. And we need to go back to those original ideals. But if we break it down in terms of what orders of worth the the critic is referring to, we can see he's referring to a different, he's contrasting two orders of worth. He's saying, the EU as it currently stands represents one order of worth, and I stand for another one, and I'm trying to kind of resurrect the what I think is the original one. But then there's a more radical critique, which Paul Blocker picked up on in the discourse of some of the left-wing groups, which is going beyond that and saying, and criticising the very ordinary notion of an institutional order itself, it's kind of a metapolitical critique of the foundations of the existing order. And it's the kind of critique where we find that the system needs to be destroyed and reconstructed on an entirely different basis, rather than there being some original ideals that we can rescue and resurrect. And he uses examples from their discourse to kind of model various different justificatory orders that people use when they talk about Europe. And he goes beyond, he makes up some of his own, or induces them rather, from the discourse of activists from the empirical material he's studying. And I won't go through the table now, I haven't got time to do that, that's in the paper on the reading list. But you can see there are various different ways we might model the EU. We can quite legitimately see and justify the EU with all of these things as a market order, as an industrial order, as an order of commonality, as a civic order, as a deliberative order, as a cosmopolitan order, or as some kind of bottom-up self-governing order. And from each of those flows a series of arguments and justifications that people will use to talk about it, if they're, and so on. He's trying, if you like, to develop a typology based partly upon which partly goes back to some traditional political theory, but also takes into account the actual discourse of these groups that he was studying, to show what kinds of notions of justice they're invoking when they talk about defend or attack different versions of Europe in political debate. And that brings us round to communication theory again. I said I'd come back to that in the final part, because that's what I want to introduce you briefly to an approach in communication theory which it's relatively easy to set to work, and I'm going to propose it as a topic for the first seminar, which is not something that all of you have to do. Remember the assessment work, I'll come back to that in a minute, but you have to choose one of the seminars as part of your assessment for this course. And I'm going to get you to use a very relatively simple technique from communication theory to analyse discourse about Europe. So, and it's grounded in what's called the community constitution of organisation approach. A couple of basic principles there are that communication is fundamental to the way in which we organise. By organisation, we're not just talking here about things we might formally call organisations, like firms, businesses, or schools, and so on. We're talking about any form of formal or informal organisation. Organising, if you like, coordination of social activity in one way or another. And it's based on the principle that organisations can't exist without communication. They're literally talked into existence, or written into existence, or so on. And it's also subscribes to the principle, which you may have come across in actor network theory, if that's terms familiar to you, that not just people, but things can act. So we need to take into account a whole range of if you like, actors, not just beyond human beings when we talk about things that can get involved in communication processes. So we can think about that in some very basic linguistic formula we use when we say things in common speech, like anger made him do it, or you know, then we're actually invoking anger as an actor, and that forced somebody to do something. So how did, an emotion, in other words, was an actor in that process that the person who made that comment is imagining. You know, so not just people, but feelings. We take into account the potential actorship, if you like, of things like feelings, concerns, principles. And that's very relevant in terms of things like concerns. You know, when we talk about what matters to us, or what sources of authority we invoke to do something, we can use a phrase like democracy dictates that, or we can use a phrase like market principles determine that must happen in this way. So again, we invoke those things, those kinds of things, as sources of authority which literally act and literally organise the situation we're dealing about, literally participate in these kind of communication events. So hopefully that becomes a bit clearer when we see how it works in practice. I'm going to use two concepts now. I'm going to try and get you to think about discourse in terms of matters of concern and matters of authority. Okay. So the idea is that when people negotiate and when they dispute with one another, when they get involved in arguments, what they're trying to do is to show that what matters to them, their matter of concern, doesn't just matter for them, but also for the people they're talking to, and ultimately for the collaborative enterprise, the organisation they belong to, the thing they're trying to do together, the thing they're negotiating about. And negotiation then becomes this process of alignment, or potentially disalignment, between the different matters of concern that participants have. So you're trying to align, I'm trying to align my matters of concern with your matters of concern, so that we can collaborate, assuming we're trying to collaborate. The result then, in any process of organising, is that some matters end up mattering more, become privileged over others, and others become marginalised. So someone's been successful in convincing others that their matters of concern are the vital ones. And those matters of concern that end up mattering more, we call them matters of authority. And they then become consequential for the way the organisation operates. So you can see that over time, some matters of concern become institutionalised as the authoritative matters for a given organisation, for a given way of working. And they literally then can co-author actions and decisions, and there's an interesting linguistic etymological connection in Latin between the terms author and authority. They both come from the Latin auctor, which means both authority and author. And the word auctor itself is derived from the verb augere, which means to augment. And that very nicely captures the idea that when something starts to matter more, it means that it has more than one author. You're literally augmenting your own authorship of a particular claim with a kind of an authoritative authorship of that claim. So we could say that when something becomes a matter of authority, what we've literally done is multiply the number of authors of a claim. So, which might apply literally in the context of the given situation. You might find people saying, you might convince people your argument was good, and you might see people nodding, and so they're literally, if you like, agreeing with, consenting to, and therefore co-authoring your claim. But also it might mean that you've done that in the claim you made by saying, and of course, so and so says that, you know, and so and so being an author who has currency within the group you're talking to. So, if I say to you in sociology that, and Bourdieu of course said that, you know, this was true, then I'm saying it's not just me that says so, it's Bourdieu that says so, and Bourdieu is an important author in sociology, therefore it's more likely to be worth listening to what I say. If you say in when you're talking to a group of economists that Friedman said so, or a group of philosophers that Aristotle said so, then again you're making your authority, you're making your claim more authoritative by saying it's not just me that says. You're multiplying the number of authors, and you can do that in a variety of ways. So, how to operationalize that when we're doing discourse analysis? When we're reading a text, if we were trying to identify the matters of concern of the speaker, of the author of that text, then we'd be trying to identify all the things that are positioned as making that speaker want to do something. Or, another way of thinking about it, it's all the things that are referred to when the speaker is trying to defend or evaluate a position, to account for it, disavow from an action, to justify or oppose an objective. I'll skip forward to the next slide so we can take the matters of concern, the matters of authority separately. So when we're looking at the matters of concern, it's often useful to come across the sorts of introductory phrases that a speaker uses. And when they use these kinds of things, you know that you're in the vicinity of matters of concern, something that matters to somebody. So if somebody says, it should be this way, it ought to be, they say, I'm concerned about it, very obviously, or I'm worried about this, I'm uneasy about that. They say, I'm interested in, it's in our interests to do something. If they use the word important, what's important, or vital, synonyms for important. Or if they say what we need to do, what we must do. If you say, well, for me it's about this, for us it's about this, again they're saying something that's important to them. If they say it matters to me, and again they're saying what's important. Or if they use words like belief. When they use all these kinds of words, they're indicating that what follows, or maybe what preceded, is something that's a matter of concern to them. You know, so these are the kind of trigger words that you need to be looking for when you're doing discourse analysis and trying to identify somebody's matters of concern. Okay. So let's think then about the matters of authority, the things that end up mattering more, things that are not just matters of concern for me, but are, if you like, institutionalised matters of concern. I would say you could define a matter of authority as an institutionalised matter of concern. And they are things that are positioned in discourse as authorising us to do something that we want to do. But they're also sometimes positioned as making us do something that we might not necessarily want to do, but we know we have to do because it's authoritative in this context. So they're setting the standard, steering our action, directing our action towards some kinds of activity that are consequential. And in that sense, they're becoming co-authors that direct action in a particular way. So, what kind of phrases might indicate someone invoking a matter of authority? You'll find these kind of introductory phrases as well. When somebody says, in the name of democracy, this is what counts, you know. On the basis of the Constitution, that's what we need to do in this situation. According to the rule book, in the interest of our organisation, in the interest of market profitability. You could probably think of plenty of other examples. In conformity with founded on, or sometimes just because, because it says so in the Bible, you know, we ought to do that. There are these are the kind of phrases people use when they invoke something that they think is authoritative, both for them and the people they're talking to. And they're using an argument of authority, linguists would say, when they do that, which is sometimes seen as a kind of a, in some context, seen as a, illegitimate technique, a kind of a slightly manipulative technique for getting someone to do something, because you know that everybody believes in democracy. So when you invoke it in a way like that, sometimes you're kind of using a slightly manipulative argument, but nevertheless you're invoking, you're orienting towards the situation where you think everybody holds democratic values as being sacred, and therefore by aligning your matter of concern with something everybody thinks is sacred, you're using a very powerful argument to get them to do something, to get them to act in a particular way. But of course, sometimes these sorts of phrases are not always explicitly invoked. We don't always see these in the text that we read. And sometimes we can hear them, if you like, paraphrased, in the way people use. So here's an example from a text where someone's talking about the European Union. This was an opinion piece, an op-ed column published by the three presidents of the European Commission, the European Council, and the European Parliament, the Troika, so-called, of European institutions, addressed to perhaps supposedly the British people, but since it was an op-ed published in a leading European newspaper in most European countries, so it was addressed more broadly to the European public on the occasion of Brexit on the 31st of January just gone, the day when Britain left the European Union officially. And they said a lot more than this, but in one quotation that's particularly interesting, they said, "How close our partnership, the partnership between Britain and the European Union, will be depends on decisions that are still to be taken, because every choice has a consequence. Without the free movement of people, there can be no free movement of capital, goods and services. Without a level playing field on the environment, labour and taxation and state aid, there cannot be the highest quality access to the single market. Without being a member, you cannot retain the benefits of membership." And I want you to try and think of what's left unsaid in this quotation. What they're referring to here are some very sort of topical issues in the negotiations with Britain, whereby Britain would like to benefit from free movement of capital, goods and services. So in the free trade negotiations that are just starting now, Britain still wants access to the single market. And they're reminding Britain here that the EU in negotiations is going to insist on that can't be the case without free movement of people as well. Okay. And what they're doing there, of course, is invoking a higher principle. There's a higher principle in European constitutions that these freedoms are not three but four, and the four freedoms are what's in constitutional terms inalienable. You can't take one without the other. So there's a unity between them. So behind what they're saying there, behind that if-then formula, without formula, they're saying They're appealing to a higher principle and saying, so I want you to imagine that we could kind of paraphrase the without in their formula by a typical phrase from that list in the name or on the basis or any of those, in fact. So if we reread it by substituting without for that one of those, we could say, in the name of the free movement of people, there can be no free movement of capital, etc. On the basis of the free movement of people, there can be no free movement of capital. You know, the sentence would still make sense if they'd used one of those other principles, those other verbs. So that's what you need to be thinking of when you read closely a text using this method of discourse analysis. You know, you're trying to say, ask yourself, at what point the speaker is invoking a higher principle, invoking a matter of authority that makes his argument more powerful by appealing to a higher principle. And again, they do it in the next sentence. Again, there's supposed to be a level playing field. That phrase, level playing field, is repeated again and again at the moment in the Brexit negotiations, and it refers to a fundamental principle in the European Union's constitution about fair, you know, the same rules for everyone. The idea of a two-speed Europe was the first thing that kind of constituted a bit of a breach in that argument. But Brexit is a much more fundamental breach, really. If they allow Britain to have some benefits of membership in the future without subscribing to the same rules. So, and again, the common standards on particularly environment law, labour law, taxation and state aid seem as fundamental principles of authority, matters of authority. The EU wants to say these are things which we cannot, and you shouldn't want to either, go against, because they're matters of authority. They want to put them, trying to position them outside the game for the upcoming negotiations by positioning them as matters of authority, not just matters of concern for the EU. Okay. And then that, just finally, that brings, obviously, basically, the task for the first seminar is basically to do the same sort of thing on a different text. It was actually a text which was published in, a similar kind of text, published a year ago by the French President Macron as an open letter to the European public in advance of the last European elections, where he puts out his European vision, really. And you'll find lots of matters of concern and matters of authority invoked in that lesson. And the task is really to kind of analyse, use that same technique to analyse his discourse in that letter, simply by listing the matters of concern and matters of authority. You could print it out and highlight it if you want, or list them in a table. And then conduct an internet search, if you want to do the second part, conduct an internet search for reactions to that letter, criticisms of that letter, and look at how his critics contested his matters of concern and invoked other matters of concern, and perhaps matters of authority as well, in order to justify their counter-arguments about Europe. So is that fairly clear?
Yeah, just practical questions. Mm-hmm. We're doing it on a semi-paper basis.
I would like, if possible, for
presentation.
Yeah, I'm going to be asking, in between now and the next session in a month's time, asking for volunteers to present. Now, there's too many of you in the group if everybody turns up for everybody to present. But if I can, the assessment will be on a written piece that you submit to me, which can be just the table. You know, it doesn't have to be like an essay type form. You could just print out his, or you know, copy and paste his letter and then highlight it in some way or other, to identify the matters of concern, and do the same for the reactions. You can comment on, or you could write a piece. So I want to see some written work for the assessment for people who choose this seminar. Remember, you don't have to choose this seminar at all. But I'd like also to, just to make it, just so I don't have to talk all the time next time, and we can, it'd be nice to have maybe three presentations. And if you want to work in groups, get together in groups. I'd really encourage that, and you could share the work task then. Someone could do Macron's letter, someone else could do the reactions, or you could look for reactions in different countries, even if you want to subdivide the task. And someone could look for reactions in France, in French. Someone could react for reactions in Czech or in English, you know, in a different country. You could, or someone could look at reactions in the mainstream media. Someone could look for reactions on Facebook, you know, that kind of thing. So if you want to look to work in groups, I'd really encourage you to do that, and it might be more fun to get together and talk about it before. Obviously, I understand that you don't all necessarily know everybody. I don't know many other people in the group, so do it yourself if you prefer. If you do work in groups, let me know by email so I know who's doing what. And if you've got any questions about practicalities, then email me in the meantime before the next session and take it from there.
15 minutes presentation?
Yeah, maximum 15 minutes, yeah.
Thank you.